Major Vizard, Reel 7. Now, we're talking about the period in the Jebel Hills. But one point I rather crossed you with was you mentioned you were personally detached to the American Second Corps. And yes. I wondered if you could explain a bit about what you were doing with them and what they were doing.
Well, I was sent there as a liaison officer to an infantry battalion. And the Americans were down in the south. There are two ranges of sand hills, really, down in the south of Tunisia, down there. And they were trying to push through there, through to we called it the Twin Tits. I can't remember the name of the formation now. But they were moving in that direction, and they had some success down there. But I went there because the brigadier, the American brigade general, had asked for six people from the British to come up and give them a bit of background, because they'd just landed and they'd moved straight up through us. They were now in the south, sandy desert. Anyway, I went and reported to this colonel, and of course I went with a bedding roll and a small kit and so on. And I had a bivvy, and I got into them. They were living a very luxurious life, I thought. They had 8-man tents in an operational area. Anyway, I had a busy and I crawled into it. The next morning I was up, usual time, just before first light. And nobody was stirring, and I went to the colonel's tent, and he said, "You're up early." I said, "Yeah, aren't you going to stand two?" Oh, he said, "I've not heard about stand two." So I said, "Well, the thing to do is that this is the time when you're liable to be attacked by fighting patrols." "Oh, it sounds a good idea," he said. "Sounds a good idea." So from there on, we had stand two. And the other amusing thing I found was that they assigned me a batman, and he was a fellow from Mississippi. He was a great fellow, Sam. And he used to come in to me, he used to come and put his head in my bivvy in the morning and say, "Good morning, sir. And what's you going to wear today?" Well, all I got was shirts, shorts, and longs. But these chaps were carrying several sets of clothes. They were living a luxurious life. It all changed for them, of course, but most of them went to Italy. But it was an amusing experience, and they were quite an effective unit. They were working quite well. They were National Guard, sort of territorial National Guard. Most of them, I think, were from East Coast and fairly south, Savannah and Charlotte and so forth, Charleston. But they were a good lot, and I enjoyed. I spent 3 weeks with them, actually, and then came back. And this was the time when the Gubalot, Gubalot Plain, the battle for the Gubalot Plain, and they had to force a way through the ridge of hills which surrounded it. And El Kuzia, the battalion, actually fought there as a battalion for only the second time since arriving in the country. Sejanine and Kuzia. They were really the only two battles fought as a battalion, and it was quite successful. We forced our way through.
What do you remember of it? I mean, how would you... do you remember the briefing? Or?
Yes. I remember the briefing, which was... it was tripartite. There were some French troops and some American troops. And I went with the colonel to his brigade headquarters, and listened in because I was lead company. And it was quite interesting. The plan had was a typical flanking movement. People moving rapidly around with carrier based and moving around to get behind the popular resistance, and our job was to push straight at it. And it was a first light. I remember it was very cold, it was misty too. We were hard by, we went very, very, very far away from the Salt Lakes. These enormous areas, vast areas of crystalline salt, which during the winter becomes a lake, during the summer dries out and becomes solid. You can walk all over, you drive vehicles over, it's so hard. We were close by. And there was quite a bit of mist, I remember. And I've always been a great believer in smoke, and I moved my company forward under a lot of smoke. And we moved up, and there was a bit of kerfuffle went on with a number of strong points.
It's not, we're not sort of concentrating on this point, but do you remember the nature of the actual fighting? Because people don't really understand what fighting's like. On the other hand, it's extremely difficult to remember.
I got wounded there. Yes. I got a failure.
Can you tell us what was going on, what you could sort of see and what you were doing?
On my left was C Company, which was George Jovey, later Professor of Archaeology at Newcastle University. George Jovey, DSO, he was kind of C Company. And he was moving forward, I could see him. I could see C Company moving forward on my left, and I was moving straight in, and there was a sort of cleft in the hills, and I was making for that. Of course, when I got there, it was strongly held on either flank. So I said to my second in command, who was a fellow called Logan, Tom Logan, subsequently killed, you take that side, I'll take this side. So we went in and attacked them, and it was pretty rough. We put down some, I called up and asked for a mortar fire on my side, I'm not sure what Tom did, I think he used smoke. Anyway, we overpowered it, we got into these dugouts, there were fellows still there, you know, they were jabbing at us, and one jabbed at me before I shot him, and then he opened up a large gash.
Your right thigh.
It was cleared up in a few weeks. But it was...
And you were using your rifle?
Yeah, I shot him with a rifle. Yeah. In the leg. I never shot anyone to kill them deliberately. I wasn't angry, you see.
That was your actual... I mean, you deliberately just shot him in the leg.
Well, unless they were likely to shoot me with their hands, then I'd do something else. But I never deliberately shot anybody that I could have saved their lives. No, I didn't see a point in it. If you're disabled, then take them prisoner. And this fellow was shot in the leg and taken prisoner and finished his war somewhere, probably down Morocco.
Now, was this the same day that Martin was killed?
Martin was further along, yes. It's the same, roughly the same period.
Because he was attacking the top of a hill called Sidi Barker, according to this. This not necessarily right, though.
Right, it is right.
And this would be on the 22nd of April.
Yeah. Sidi Barker was on the extreme right. C Company was here, I was here, and Major Martin, Keith. I never knew him long enough. He came to the battalion. The previous company commander in B had been Johnny Johnson, a regular officer, South Wales Borders, and he subsequently left. Finished with a red hat. And so the new man, Martin, I'd hardly met him. You see, there was no social life in the battalion at all. We were constantly with our companies on the hills. And you got natty rations, and you get a bottle of whiskey once a month. And there was a few bottles of beer, but not very much. and you know, socialise. I can remember crawling across the valley to go and see Tommy Johnson, and I said to him, "I've just got a new Thunderbox. Would you like to visit?" Because Thunderbox is an extremely important element. If you could get your parents, your people at home, to send you a Bronco, things like that, you know, Army form blank, pretty rough, especially with sand. But if you could get Bronco sent, then you can actually invite people to come over, have a drop of whiskey from your bottle, go out and try the Thunderbox. And I used to specialise in getting the a nice one with a proper seat, which I carried. Because I had an 800-weight truck. I carried this on the truck, and I used to invite people in to have it at a Thunderbox party. People used to go around there and have a good crack. It's incredible. These small things become so important. I can remember traversing a difficult area because it was under fire in order to go and call on somebody who got a tin of jam from home. Army and Navy stores sent him a tin of jam. Yes, that was the Jebel Barker, and that's where Tom Reynolds took over and fought the rest of that battle.
That was your former...
he was second in command of E, and he moved into second in command of B, and became company commander of B. The company sergeant major of B, quite a distinguished fellow, Arthur Pearson, he died last year and I went to his funeral. Arthur Pearson, company sergeant major, commissioned in the field and went to the Hampshires, finished as major MC. Good show. And he was company sergeant major of B. Tom was second in command and Martin was the boss. Both me and Tom Logan, and my CSM at that time was a fellow called Wilson, who had been in company quartermaster sergeant, curiously enough, in E Company. But he emerged from Q, and he was an extremely good company sergeant.
And that they were your team when you cleared the sides of this gap?
Yes, we moved through it then. And our job was to clear that, because it opened the Gubalap plain. And having opened that, you could get armour through.
And presumably, from the sound of this, you turned the flank of Sidi Barker, the Jebel Barker.
That was the flank on that side. That's moving around the flank.
So they withdrew.
Laurie Stringer's right, because Major Martin's task and subsequently Tom Reynolds' task was to push on, and he finished up several miles ahead of me. I was level with C Company, but B Company was way up. And I'm trying to think of the dorsals, I think, the eastern dorsal and the western dorsal. These were ranges of hills, and we come to the western dorsal. And they're virtually sand hills, held together by blades of grass. And the other side of this rocky cleft that we went through and opened up for the road to get armour through, the other side were this is western dorsal. Sand, great huge sand hills, difficult to walk up. One pace forward, two paces back, sort of thing. But that was the last time the battalion fought as a unit, because after that it was the chase. Jerry was retreating back across towards Tunis. There wasn't a lot. We'd beyond the sand area of the Gubalap plain, you come to the huge Roman granaries of wheat. As far as the eye could see, there was wheat, nothing but wheat, and it was in full, because by now it was 18. Early May. Couldn't have been early May, because they jacked it in on the thing. Late April, I suppose, and the fields were very ripe, and it was the Americans were there, and they'd made tracks through these vast prairie-like fields of wheat.
Now, you were in lorries, were you?
For the advance on the chase, yes.
Were they your lorries, or were they supplied to you and then taken away?
The trucks that I moved in on towards them, the Bizerta on the left and Tunis straight ahead. mine was a captured Jerry one, which I got it had been used by the troops that we overcame.
And what about the men? Who were they transported?
Three-ton trucks from the battalion, yes.
So you were properly motorised battalion?
Yes, properly motorised. We didn't see a lot of movement by road because by daytime it still hadn't got full superiority. Nighttime movement by three-tonners was no use in the hills. And they were useful for bringing up rations on the road and then onto the mules. Carriers would get up the hills, although even they got stuck. If the rocks would break the treads. But then the chase began towards Tunis. It was an unusual sensation. You got out of your vehicles and you moved into these tracks, and they'd been cut quite precisely. I don't know how they did it, but somebody, I think it was the Americans, because they had boot tracks. They all led, and your feet was 5 or 6 feet high on either side. You couldn't see anything. You were walking through, almost like walking through a jungle, with green and yellow heads and wheat and so on. And you were walking through these tracks and driving through these tracks, and moving up towards Mateur. Mateur was the town we took. There was no one there. We say we took it, but we drove into it. There was nobody in the town, no Jerrys anyway. I think there were a few wounded Jerrys, but nothing else. And they'd all retreated back towards La Goulette in the hopes of getting vehicles. But by that time, of course, 8th Army had moved up. They were in, I think, well, they must have been almost in the town, I don't know. They were certainly through Sfax. And the Jerry horses were caught in the pincer. The strong 8th Army and the rather mediocre 1st Army, it was only a little army. Kenneth Anderson was the army commander. The 46th Division was Freeman Atwood. Known as Freeman Hardy Willis by the troops. Freeman Atwood, he was the divisional commander, 46, and the brigade commander was a man who left his name on the map, Hunt's Gap, Brigadier Hunt. he gave the speech from Henry V, you know, once more into the breach, you'll leave the gap with our English dead. But we didn't leave very many English dead, but it was ever after known as Hunt's Gap. Even on military maps, you'll find Hunt's Gap. And he was a brigade commander.
What did you think of your senior commanders, or was it out of your orbit?
I had the greatest admiration for Johnny Preston. He was a first-class commander. He put people where they could do the maximum damage. And he was a tactician, very good indeed, and he kept spirits alive. He was a cheerful man.
What about above him, the brigadier and the divisional?
Before you leave, Johnny, a little story. I can remember Johnny Preston, when we paused for 2 days, he gathered Arab children. A lot of Arab children still around. We used to live in bog huts. Arab children, he gathered a group of about 20, and he taught them to sing, "You Are My Sunshine." They had no idea what these words meant. They copied the sounds. And he was very proud, and he stood there and conducted, "You Are My Sunshine." And that whimsical smile and those twinkling blue eyes, you know, he was a great character. That's involving in the middle of a war to teach 20 Arab kids to sing, "You Are My Sunshine." It was a popular song at the time, because troops loved it. Well, it was magnificent. Had all these Arab kids on their lap, you know, chocolate was given to them and so on. A great commander. Now, Hunt was a good man. I didn't see a great deal of him because we were all broken up all the time in Africa. Um, subsequently, Consequently, after the fall of Tunis, and we arrived in fairly late, people got in before us. We were bringing up, we did a bit of skirmishing in Medjez El Bab, but it wasn't more than skirmishing. There were people firing from buildings. There was a bit of street clearing to be done, one or two house clearings.
Were you involved in that? What do you remember of it?
Only that I was grateful to the battle school, who had given me a very sound grounding in house clearing and street clearing, wood clearing and so on.
How did you go about it in that case?
I filled my pouches with grenades.
Which type? Stun or...?
I had all. I had smoke and stun on the left, and I had high explosive on the right. And it was, you know, just chuck it in and wait for it to go off. Make sure they didn't... It hold it long enough, otherwise they'd throw it out again. And then either it would disable them, or some of them would come stumbling out, and you could very quickly deal with them then. It was quite not difficult. The difficult thing is when you're approaching, if you can get under the walls at the base of the building, hard against the building, then they're going to have to poke their heads out to do anything about you. And having done that, they'd expose themselves. But getting to the building is the tricky thing. And once you're in, of course, you can move round the back and then round to the next one and come in that. And it's a drill. And the troops knew the drill. They know they taught. Well, most of my men were still young soldiers, and they knew the drill because they'd done it. We had, sadly, we had a Teesdale village to practice in. They evacuated a Teesdale village. And they turned it into a firing range, virtually, and we used to use live ammo and smoke and stun. We didn't stay in Tunis very long. We were based in a place called the Palais Arab, which was a department store. Tunis, which had been the base for German soldiers for a long time, and French before that. Marshal Juin had been the commander of the French forces there. We didn't remain very long in Tunis. The people said they were pleased to see us, but then what else could they say? They turned out in the streets and they cheered. I suppose if they were French, they would be pleased to see Allied forces come. I had a poor opinion of the Pied Noir, the French Algerian Tunisian farmer. It seemed to me that he treated his animals and his vehicles and his women folk much the same way. He drove everything till it dropped. Tyrannical. That was the Pied Noir. We didn't meet a great many of them because, of course, they cleared out of the way before the war moved towards them. But they were, of course, in Tunis, and we moved to...
Was there any opportunity for recreation in Tunis? I mean, to get out to the bars?
Not a lot, no. We moved to Hammamet, which is just south of Tunis. I think it's a holiday resort now. Hammamet or Hammamlif, I can't remember.
Can I just ask about the... During the Great Victory Parade, you weren't on it, the 20th of May. You were guarding prisoners of war, according to this.
Right, we were. We did POW duty.
How did you feel about missing the parade?
Didn't care very much. We, I mean, parades are fine, aren't they? But if our wives could have been there, and our girlfriends and our mothers to see the parade, well, we would be very happy to turn out. But for a bunch of French civvies, that's all that was there. Cameramen were there. Pappy News, no doubt, had his arm there. I expect they had it running in the cinemas of them, but we weren't on it. The place was running hot and cold with POWs. There must be a quarter of a million of them. And the battalion moved into quarters in Hammamlif. Maybe Hammamlif or Hammamet.
That looks right, yeah, Hammamlif.
Hammamlif, yes. But I and a small Kada and other officers, each with his own small Kada, took train loads of POW down to Casablanca by train. And it took 3 weeks. You'd load these chaps on. Majority of those on my train were Africa Corps, bronzed, young, 21, 22, fair-haired, blue-eyed, vigorous, well-disciplined, not at all their spirit broken, not at all. Well-behaved, they were in charge of a Feldwebel, and all orders were given through him. His English was excellent. I had some German because I went to Heidelberg, a university, for a short time. I picked up enough German to manage. Anyway, these trains, you see, they were operated by the French, and the French didn't understand English or German. My French was limited, but I managed to get sufficient. But the drivers used to say that the nous sommes du parti à 8h or something of the kind, and we'd think, okay, we're ready for 8 o'clock. In fact, they'd start the engine up, and all the hissing and roaring steam would come out of it and so on, at about 7:30. And so all the lads, the Kader, because we had one chap on each, 40 men, 8 horses, you know, it is always the same, whether it's Germans or British or French, it's always eight horses or 40 men. And a lot of the fellows were suffering from diarrhea. It was quite serious, dysentery.
The prisoners?
Well, some of theirs too, but the prisoners, they had it quite badly, dysentery. I had a medical sergeant for train, and he dished out stuff. But you see, the great trouble with that train, it took 3 weeks to get down to Casablanca. Great trouble with it was the lack of communication with the guard and the driver. The fellows used to get off, it moved at little more than walking pace, so slow. It did get up a bit between, you know, 20-mile stretches, it would move a bit faster, but it moved so slowly. And the big trouble was that the chaps would get out of the truck, go away to 100 yards and so on, relieve themselves. Then they'd come back, and meantime, everybody had got out, and somebody had brewed up, Tommy Cooker wise. Maybe you had a tripod with a pot. Some of the African war fellows had got some cooking gear with them, and they used to cook on the way. Then, of course, suddenly there'd be a great clanking of shunting going on in the train, and everybody thought, oh my God, it's going again. And so they'd drag all their gear up, and running by the side of the train, they'd put it in, go back, but enough time, because it moves so slowly, pick up their gear, run down, and pick up a third time, and run down, stamp out the fires, and so forth. I mean, totally uncoordinated, unregimented, and no regime. The driver stopped at Philippeville. And I said to him, why have you stopped at Philippeville? Philippeville is not a stopping place. Ah, he said, my wife's mother, she lives in Philippeville. So he stopped the train for 6 hours while he went to see his mother-in-law. That was the sort of... Anyway, we eventually got there. I began with 1,230, and I finished with 1,280. I'd lost people on the way because they'd been left behind when the train went off. They were still spotting. Others who'd been left behind by the train in front, they jumped onto my train. And I arrived with 50 more than I started with. And I think this is what happened to quite a lot of people.